Chapter 14. Audio log. Soul 119. Recording. I've been laying here for a little while trying to figure out what happened. I should be more upset, but I took a pretty good whack to the head. It had a calming effect, so... Well, okay. I'm in the airlock. I can see the HAB out the window. It's a good 50 meters away. Normally the airlock is attached to the HAB, so that's a problem. The airlock's on its side, and I can hear a steady hiss. So either it's leaking, or there are snakes in here. Either way, I'm in trouble. Also, during the... whatever the fuck happened, I got bounced around like a pinball and smashed my faceplate. Air is notoriously uncooperative when it comes to giant gaping holes in your EVA suit. Looks like the HAB is completely deflated and collapsed, so even if I had a functional EVA suit to leave the airlock with, I wouldn't have anywhere to go. So that sucks. I gotta think for a minute. And I have to get out of this EVA suit. It's bulky and the airlock is cramped. Besides, it's not like it's doing me any good. Audio log. Soul 119. Recording. Things aren't as bad as they seem. I'm still fucked, mind you, just not as deeply. Not sure what happened to the HAB, but the rover's probably fine. It's not ideal, but at least it's not a leaky phone booth. I'm wearing Beck's EVA suit. I haven't worn my own since Sol 6 when I got shish kebabbed. Beck's suit was about the right size and didn't have a hole in it. Why does that matter right now? Because unlike my original suit, this one still has an unused patch kit. Now don't get excited. It won't do the suit any good. The patch kit is a cone-shaped valve with a super sticky resin on the wide end. It's just too small to deal with a hole larger than 8 centimeters. And really, if you have a 9-centimeter hole, you're going to be dead way before you could whip out the kit. Still, it's an asset, and maybe I can use it to stop the airlock leak. And that's my top priority right now. It's a small leak. With the faceplate gone, the EVA suit is effectively managing the whole airlock. It's been adding air to make up for the missing pressure, but it'll run out eventually. I need to find the leak. I think it's near my feet, judging by the sound. Now that I'm out of the suit, I can turn around and get a look. I don't see anything. I can hear it, but... it's down here somewhere, but I don't know where. I can only think of one way to find it. Start a fire. Yeah, I know. A lot of my ideas involve setting something on fire, and yes, deliberately starting a fire in a tiny, enclosed space is usually a terrible idea. But I need the smoke, just a little wisp of it. As usual, I'm working with stuff that was deliberately designed not to burn, but no amount of careful design by NASA can get around a determined arsonist with a tank of pure oxygen. The EVA suit is made entirely of non-flammable materials. So is the airlock. My clothes are fireproof as well, even the thread. I was originally planning to check the solar array, doing repairs as needed after last night's storm. So I have my toolbox with me. But looking through it, it's all metal or non-flammable plastic. I just realized I do have something flammable. My own hair. It'll have to do. There's a sharp knife in the toolkit. I'll shave some arm hairs off into a little pile. Next step, oxygen. Back when I turned the hydrazine into water, I had tubing, garbage bags, and all sorts of other luxuries. I won't have anything so refined as a pure oxygen flow. All I can do is muck with the EVA suit controls to increase oxygen percentage in the whole airlock. I figure bumping it to 40% will do. All I need now is a spark. The EVA suit has electronics, but it runs on very low voltage. I don't think that I can get an arc with it. Besides, I don't want to tear up my suit's electronics. I need it working to get from the airlock to the rover. The airlock itself has electronics, but it ran on HAB power. I guess NASA never considered what would happen if it was launched 50 meters. Lazy bums. Plastic might not burn, but anyone who's played with a balloon knows it's great at building up static charge. Once I do that, I should be able to make a spark just by touching a metal tool. Fun fact, this is exactly how the Apollo 1 crew died. Wish me luck! Audio log. Soul 119. Recording. I'm in a full box of burning hair smell. It's not a good smell. On my first try, the fire lit, but the smoke just drifted randomly around. My own breathing was screwing it up, so I held my breath and tried again. My second try, the EVA suit threw everything off. There's a gentle flow of air coming out of the faceplate as the suit constantly replaces the missing air. So I shut the suit down, held my breath, and tried again. I had to be quick. The pressure was dropping. My third try, the quick arm movements I used to set the fire messed everything up. Just moving around makes enough turbulence to send the smoke everywhere. The fourth time, I kept the suit turned off, held my breath, and when the time came to light the fire, I did it very slowly. Then I watched as the little wisp of smoke drifted toward the floor of the airlock, disappearing through a hairline fracture. "I have you now, little leak." I gasped for air and turned the EVA suit back on. The pressure had dropped to 0.9 atmospheres during my little experiment, but there was plenty of oxygen in the air for me and my hair fire to breathe. The suit quickly got things back to normal. Looking at the fracture, it's pretty tiny. It would be a cinch to seal it with the suit's patch kit, but now that I think about it, that's a bad idea. I'll need to do some kind of repair to the faceplate. I don't know how just yet, but the patch kit and its pressure-resistant resin is probably really important. And I can't do it bit by bit either. Once I break the seal on the patch kit, the binary components of the resin mix, and I have 60 seconds before it hardens. I can't just take a little to fix the crack. Given time, I might be able to come up with a plan for the faceplate. Then I could take a few seconds during that plan to scrape resin over the airlock fracture, but I don't have time. I'm down to 40% of my N2 tank. I need to seal that fracture now, and I need to do it without using the patch kit. First idea. Little Dutch boy. I'm licking my palm and placing it over the crack. Okay, I can't quite make a perfect seal, so there's airflow. Getting colder now. Getting pretty uncomfortable. Okay, fuck this. On to idea number two. Tape. I have duct tape in my toolbox. Let's slap some on and see if it slows the flow. I wonder how long it will last before the pressure rips it. Putting it on now. There we go. Still holding. Let me check the suit. Readouts say the pressure is stable. Looks like the duct tape made a good seal. Let's see if it holds. Audio log. Soul 119. Recording. It's been 15 minutes and the tape is still holding. Looks like that problem is solved. Sort of anticlimactic, really. I was already working out how to cover the breach with ice. I have 2 liters of water in the EVA suit's hamster feeder. I could have shut off the suit's heating systems and let the airlock cool to freezing. Then I'd... well, whatever. Could have done it with ice, I'm just saying. All right. On to my next problem. How do I fix the EVA suit? Duct tape might seal a hairline crack, but it can't hold an atmosphere of pressure against the size of my broken faceplate. The patch kit is too small, but still useful. I can spread the resin around the edge of where the faceplate was, then stick something on to cover the hole. Problem is, what do I use to cover the hole? Something that can stand up to a lot of pressure. Looking around, the only thing I see that can hold an atmosphere is the EVA suit itself. There's plenty of material to work with, and I can even cut it. Remember when I was cutting hab canvas into strips? Those same shears are right here in my toolkit. Cutting a chunk out of my EVA suit leaves it with another hole, but a hole I can control the shape and location of. Yeah, I think I see a solution here. I'm going to cut off my arm. Well, no, not my arm, the EVA suit's arm. I'll cut right below the left elbow. Then I can cut along its length, turning it into a rectangle. It'll be big enough to seal the faceplate, and it'll be held in place by the resin. Material designed to withstand atmospheric pressure? Check. Resin designed to seal a breach against that pressure? Check. And what about the gaping hole on the stumpy arm? Unlike my faceplate, the suit's material is flexible. I'll press it together and seal it with resin. I'll have to press my left arm against my side while I'm in the suit, but there'll be room. I'll be spreading the resin pretty thin, but it's literally the strongest adhesive known to man, and it doesn't have to be a perfect seal. It just has to last long enough for me to get to safety. And where will that safety be? Not a damn clue. Anyway, one problem at a time. Right now, I'm fixing the EVA suit. Audio log, Sol 119. Recording. Cutting the arm off the suit was easy, so was cutting along its length to make a rectangle. Those shears are strong as hell. Cleaning the glass off the faceplate took longer than I'd expected. It's unlikely it would puncture EVA suit material, but I'm not taking any chances. Besides, I don't want glass in my face when I'm wearing it. Then came the tricky part. Once I broke the seal on the patch kit, I had 60 seconds before the resin set. I scooped it off the patch kit with my fingers and quickly spread it around the rim of the faceplate. Then I took what was left and sealed the armhole. I pressed the rectangle of suit material onto the helmet. I held it firmly with both hands while using my knee to keep pressure on the arm seam. I held on until I'd counted 120 seconds, just to be sure. It seemed to work well. The seal looked strong and the resin was rock hard. I did, however, glue my hand to the helmet. Stop laughing. In retrospect, using my fingers to spread the resin wasn't the best plan. Fortunately, my left hand was still free. After some grunting and a lot of profanities, I was able to reach the toolbox. Once I got the screwdriver, I chiseled myself free, feeling really stupid the whole time. Using the arm computer, I had the suit overpressurized to 1.2 atmospheres. The faceplate patch bowed outwards but otherwise held firm. The arm filled in, threatening to tear the new seam but stayed in one piece. Then I watched the readouts to see how airtight things were. Answer: not very. The suit is designed for 8 hours of use. That works out to 250 milliliters of liquid oxygen. Just to be safe, the suit has a full liter of O2 capacity. But that's only half the story. The rest of the air is nitrogen. It's just there to add pressure. When the suit leaks, that's what it backfills with. The suit has 2 liters of liquid N2 storage. It absolutely pissed the air out. In 60 seconds, it leaked so much it pressurized the whole airlock to 1.2 atmospheres. Let's call the volume of the airlock 2 cubic meters. The inflated EVA suit probably takes up half of it, so it took 5 minutes to add 0.2 atmospheres to 1 cubic meter. That's 285 grams of air. Trust me on the math. The air in the tanks is around 1 gram per cubic centimeter, meaning I just lost 285 milliliters. The 3 tanks combined had 3,000 milliliters to start with. A lot of that was used to maintain pressure while the airlock was leaking. Also, my breathing turned some oxygen into carbon dioxide, which was captured by the suit's CO2 filters. Checking the readouts, I have 410 milliliters of oxygen, 738 milliliters of nitrogen. Together, they make almost 1,150 milliliters to work with. That divided by 285 milliliters lost per minute. Once I'm out of the airlock, this EVA suit will only last 4 minutes. Fuck. Audio log. Sol 119. Recording. Okay, I've been thinking some more. What good is going to the rover? I'd just be trapped there instead. The extra room would be nice, but I'd still die eventually. No water reclaimer, no oxygenator, no food. Take your pick. All of those problems are fatal. I need to fix the HAB. I know what to do. We practiced it in training, but it'll take a long time. I'll have to scrounge around in the now collapsed canvas to get the spare material for patching. Then I have to find the breech and seal strip a patch in place. But it'll take hours to repair, and my EVA suit is shit. I'll need another suit. Martinez's used to be in the rover. I hauled it all the way to the Pathfinder site and back just in case I needed a spare. But when I returned, I put it back in the HAB. Damn it! All right, so I'll need to get another suit before going to the rover. Which one? Johansson's is too small for me. Tiny little gal, our Johansson. Lewis's is full of water. Actually, by now it's full of slowly sublimating ice. The mangled, glued-together suit I have with me is Beck's. My original suit has a hole in it. That just leaves Martinez and Vogel. I left Martinez's near my bunk in case I needed a suit in a hurry. Of course, after that sudden decompression, it could be anywhere. Still, it's a place to start. Next problem. I'm like 50 meters from the HAB. Running in 0.4 gravity while wearing a bulky EVA suit isn't easy. At best, I can trundle 2 meters per second. That's a precious 25 seconds, almost an eighth of my 4 minutes. I've got to bring that down, but how? Audio log, Sol 119, recording. I'll roll the damn airlock. It's basically a phone booth on its side. I did some experiments. I figured if I want it to roll, I'll need to hit the wall as hard as possible, and I have to be in the air at the time. I can't press against some other part of the airlock. The forces would cancel, and it wouldn't move at all. First, I tried launching myself off one wall and slamming into the other. The airlock slid a little, but that's it. Next, I tried doing a super push-up to get airborne. 0.4 gravity. Yay! Then kicking the wall with both feet. Again, it just slid. The third time, I got it right. The trick is to plant both my feet on the ground near the wall. Then I launched myself to the top of the opposite wall and hit with my back. When I tried that just now, it was enough force and leverage to tip the airlock and roll it one face toward the hab. The airlock is a meter wide, so... sigh. I have to do it like 50 more times. I'm gonna have a hell of a backache after this. Audio log, Sol 120. Recording. I have a hell of a backache. The subtle and refined hurl my body at the wall technique had some flaws. It only worked 1 out of every 10 tries, and it hurt a lot. I had to take breaks, stretch out, and generally convince myself to body slam the wall again and again. It took all damn night, but I made it. I'm 10 meters from the hab now. I can't get any closer because the debris from the decompression is all over the place. This isn't an all-terrain airlock. I can't roll over that shit. It was morning when the hab popped. Now it's morning again. I've been in this damn box for an entire day, but I'm leaving soon. I'm in the EVA suit now and ready to roll. All right. Okay. Once more through the plan. Use the manual valves to equalize the airlock. Get out and hurry to the hab. Wander around under the collapsed canvas. Find Martinez's suit, or Vogel's if I run into it first. Get to the rover. Then I'm safe. If I run out of time before finding a suit, I'll just run to the rover. I'd be in trouble, but I'd have time to think and materials to work with. Deep breath. Here we go. Log entry. Sol 120. I'm alive, and I'm in the rover. Things didn't go exactly as planned, but I'm not dead, so it's a win. Equalizing the airlock went fine. I was out on the surface within 30 seconds, skipping toward the hab, the fastest way to move in this gravity. I passed through the field of debris. The rupture had really sent things flying, myself included. It was hard to see. My faceplate was covered by the makeshift patch. Fortunately, my arm had a camera. NASA discovered that turning your whole EVA-suited body to look at something was a strenuous waste of time, so they mounted a small camera on the right arm. The feed is projected on the inner faceplate. This allows us to look at things just by pointing at them. I had to look at a rippled, messed-up version of the outside world. The faceplate patch wasn't exactly smooth or reflective. Still, it was enough to see what was going on. I beelined for where the airlock used to be. I knew there had to be a pretty big hole there, so I'd be able to get in. I found it easily, and boy is it a nasty rip. It's going to be a pain in the ass to fix it. That's when the flaws in my plan started to reveal themselves. I only had one arm to work with. My left arm was pinned against my body while the stumpy arm of the suit bounced freely. So as I moved around under the canvas, I had to use my one good arm to hold the canvas up. It slowed me down. From what I could see, the interior of the hab is chaos. Everything's moved. Entire tables and bunks are meters away from where they started. Lighter objects are wildly jumbled, many of them out on the surface. Everything's covered in soil and mangled potato plants. Trudging onward, I got to where I'd left Martinez's suit. To my shock, it was still there. Yay, I naively thought. Problem solved. Unfortunately, the suit was pinned under a table, which was held down by the collapsed canvas. If I'd had both arms, I could have pulled it free, but with only one, I just couldn't do it. Running low on time, I detached the helmet. Setting it aside, I reached past the table to get Martinez's patch kit. I found it with the help of the arm camera. I dropped it in the helmet and hauled ass out of there. Stumbling to the rover, I barely made it in time. My ears were popping from pressure loss just as the rover's airlock filled with wonderful one-atmosphere air. Crawling in, I collapsed and panted for a moment. So I'm back in the rover, just like I was back on the Great Pathfinder Recovery Expedition. Ugh. At least this time it smells a little better. NASA's probably pretty worried about me by now. They probably saw the airlock move back to the HAB, so they know I'm alive, but they'll want status. And as it happens, it's the rover that communicates with Pathfinder. I tried to send a message, but Pathfinder isn't responding. That's not a big surprise. It's powered directly from the HAB, and the HAB is offline. During my brief panicked scramble outside, I saw Pathfinder was right where I left it, and the debris didn't reach that far out. It should be fine once I get it some power. As for my current situation, the big gain is the helmet. They're interchangeable, so I can replace my broken-ass one with Martinez's. The stumpy arm is still an issue, but the faceplate was the main source of leaks, and with the fresh patch kit, I can seal the arm with more resin. But that can wait. I've been awake for over 24 hours. I'm not in any immediate danger, so I'm going to sleep. Log entry, Sol 121. Got a good night's sleep and made real progress today. First thing I did was reseal the arm. Last time I had to spread the resin pretty thin. I'd used most of it for the faceplate patch. But this time I had a whole patch kit just for the arm. I got a perfect seal. I still only had a one-armed suit, but at least it didn't leak. I'd lost most of my air yesterday, but I had a half hour of oxygen left. Like I said earlier, a human body doesn't need much oxygen. Maintaining pressure was the problem. With that much time, I was able to take advantage of the rover's EVA tank refill, something I couldn't do with the leaky suit. The tank refill is an emergency measure. The expected use of the rover is to start with full EVA suits and come back with air to spare. It wasn't designed for long trips or even overnighters. But just in case of emergency, it has refill hoses mounted on the exterior. Inside space was limited already, and NASA concluded most air-related emergencies would be outdoors. But refilling is slow, slower than my suit was leaking, so it wasn't any use to me. Now, with a solid suit capable of holding pressure, refilling the tanks was a breeze. After refilling and making sure the suit was still not leaking, I had a few immediate tasks to take care of. Much as I trust my handiwork, I wanted a two-armed suit. I ventured back into the HAB, this time not being rushed. I was able to use a pole to leverage the table off Martinez's suit. Pulling it loose, I dragged it back to the rover. After a thorough diagnostic, to be sure, I finally had a fully functional EVA suit. It took me two trips to get it, but I got it. Tomorrow I'll fix the HAB. Log entry, Sol 122. The first thing I did today was line up rocks near the rover to spell A-OK. That should make NASA happy. I went into the HAB again to assess damage. My priority will be to get the structure intact and holding pressure. From there, I can work on fixing stuff that broke. The HAB is normally a dome, with flexible support poles maintaining the arch and rigid, folding floor material to keep it flat. The internal pressure was a vital part of its support. Without it, the whole thing collapsed. I inspected the poles and none of them had broken. They're just lying flat is all. I'll have to recouple a few of them, but that'll be easy. The hole where airlock 1 used to be is huge but surmountable. I have seal strips and spare canvas. It'll be a lot of work, but I can get the HAB together again. Once I do, I'll reestablish power and get Pathfinder back online. From there, NASA can tell me how to fix anything I can't figure out on my own. I'm not worried about any of that. I have a much bigger problem. The farm is dead. With a complete loss of pressure, most of the water boiled off. Also, the temperature is well below freezing. Not even the bacteria in the soil can survive a catastrophe like that. Some of the crops were in pop tents off the HAB, but they're dead too. I had them connected directly to the HAB via hoses to maintain air supply and temperature. When the HAB blew, the pop tents depressurized as well. Even if they hadn't, the freezing cold would have killed them. Potatoes are now extinct on Mars. So are earthworms and soil bacteria. I'll never grow another plant so long as I'm here. We had it all planned out. My farm would give me food till Sol 900. A supply probe would get here on Sol 856, way before I ran out. With the farm dead, that plan is history. The ration packs won't have been affected by the explosion. And the potatoes may be dead, but there's still food. I was just about to harvest, so it was a good time for this to happen, I guess. The rations will last me till Sol 400. I can't say for sure how long the potatoes will last until I see how many I got, but I can estimate. I have 400 plants, probably averaging 5 potatoes each. 2,000 taters, at 150 calories each. I'll need to eat 10 per sol to survive. That means they'll last me 200 sols. Grand total, I have enough food to last till Sol 600. By Sol 856, I'll be long dead. Chapter 15 Project Iris 0800 hours, 12 minutes Watney Test 0800 hours, 25 minutes JPL Received. You gave us quite a scare there. Thanks for the A-OK message. Our analysis of satellite imagery shows a complete detachment of Airlock 1. Is that correct? What's your status? Include your personal health and HAB equipment. 0800 hours, 39 minutes. Watney. If by detachment you mean shot me out like a cannon, then yeah. Minor cut on my forehead. Had some issues with my EVA suit. I'll explain later. I patched up the HAB and repressurized it. Main air tanks were intact. I just got power back online. Primary air and water tanks were unharmed. The rover, solar array, and Pathfinder were out of blast range. I'll run diagnostics on the HAB's system while I wait for your next reply. By the way, who am I talking to? 0800 hours, 52 minutes. JPL. Venkat Kapoor in Houston. Pasadena relays my messages. I'm going to handle all direct communication with you from now on. Check the oxygenator and water reclaimer first. They're the most important. 0900 hours, 5 minutes. Watney. Duh. Oxygenator functioning perfectly. Water reclaimer is completely offline. Best guess is water froze up inside and burst some tubing. I'm sure I can fix it. HAB's main computer also functioning without any problems. Any idea what caused the HAB to blow up? 0900 hours, 18 minutes. JPL. Best guess is fatigue on the canvas near Airlock 1. The pressurization cycle stressed it until it failed. From now on, alternate Airlock 2 and 3 for all EVAs. Also, we'll be getting you a checklist and procedures for a full canvas exam. 0900 hours, 31 minutes. Watney. Yay, I get to stare at a wall for several hours. By the way, the farm is dead. I've recovered as many potatoes as I could and stored them outside. I count 1,841. That will last me 184 days. Including the remaining mission rations, I'll start starving on Sol 584. 0900 hours, 44 minutes, JPL. Yeah, we figured. Working on it.
It's Sol 122, Bruce said. We have until Sol 584 to get a probe to Mars. That's 462 sols, which is 475 days.
The assembled department heads of JPL furrowed their brows and rubbed their eyes.
First, they needed a pre-supply way ahead of schedule, Bruce continued. Now they need it even more ahead of schedule.
He stood from his chair.
The positions of Earth and Mars aren't ideal. The trip will take 414 days. Mounting the probe to the booster and dealing with inspections will take 13 days. That leaves us with just 48 days to make this probe.
Sounds of whispered exasperation filled the room.
Jesus, someone said.
It's a whole new ballgame, Bruce continued. Our focus is food. Anything else is a luxury. We don't have time to make a powered descent lander. It'll have to be a tumbler, so we can't put anything delicate inside. Say goodbye to all the other crap we'd planned to send.
Where's the booster coming from?
Asked Norm Toshi, who was in charge of the re-entry process. The Eagle Eye 3 Saturn probe, Bruce said. It was scheduled to launch next month. NASA put it on hold so we can have the booster.
I bet the Eagle Eye team was pissed about that, Norm said.
I'm sure they were, Bruce said. But it's the only booster we have that's big enough. Which brings me to my next point. We only get one shot at this. If we fuck it up, Mark Watney dies. He looked around the room and let that sink in. We do have some things going for us, he finally said. We have some of the parts built for the Ares 4 pre-supply missions. We can steal from them, and that'll save us some time. Also, we are sending food, which is pretty robust. Even if there's a re-entry problem and the probe impacts at high velocity, food is still food. And we don't need a precision landing. Watney can travel hundreds of kilometers if necessary. We just need to land close enough for him to reach it. This ends up being a standard Tumberland pre-supply. All we have to do is make it quickly. So let's get to it.
0800 hours, 2 minutes. JPL. We've spun up a project to get you food. It's been in progress for a week or so. We can get it to you before you starve, but it'll be tight. It'll just be food and a radio. We can't send an oxygenator, water reclaimer, or any of that other stuff without powered descent.
0800 hours, 16 minutes. Watney.
No complaints here. You get me the food, I'll be a happy camper. I've got all HAB systems up and running again. The water reclaimer is working fine now that I replaced the burst hoses. As for water supply, I have 620 liters remaining. I started with 900 liters, 300 to start with, 600 more from reducing hydrazine. So I lost almost 300 liters to sublimation. Still, with the water reclaimer operational again, it's plenty.
0800 hours, 31 minutes. JPL.
Good. Keep us posted on any mechanical or electronic problems. By the way, the name of the probe we're sending is Iris. Named after the Greek goddess who traveled the heavens with the speed of wind. She's also the goddess of rainbows.
0800 hours, 47 minutes. Watney.
Gay probe coming to save me. Got it.
Rich Purnell sipped coffee in the silent building. Only his cubicle illuminated the otherwise dark room. Continuing with his computations, he ran a final test on the software he'd written. It passed. With a relieved sigh, he sank back in his chair. Checking the clock on his computer, he shook his head. 3:42 a.m. Being an astrodynamicist, Rich rarely had to work late. His job was to find the exact orbits and course corrections needed for any given mission. Usually it was one of the first parts of a project, all the other steps being based on the orbit. But this time, things were reversed. Iris needed an orbital path, and nobody knew when it would launch. A non-Hoffman Mars transfer isn't challenging, but it does require the exact locations of Earth and Mars. Planets move as time goes by. A course calculated for a specific launch date will work only for that date. Even a single day's difference would result in missing Mars entirely. So Rich had to calculate many courses. He had a range of 25 days during which Iris might launch. He calculated one course for each. He began an email to his boss.
Mike, he typed. Attached are the courses for Iris in one-day increments. We should start peer review and vetting so they can be officially accepted. And you were right. I was here almost all night. It wasn't that bad. Nowhere near the pain of calculating orbits for Hermes. I know you get bored when I go into the math, so I'll summarize. The small, constant thrust of Hermes' ion drives is much harder to deal with than the large point thrusts of pre-supply probes. All 25 of the courses take 414 days and vary only slightly in thrust duration and angle.
the fuel requirement is nearly identical for the orbits and is well within the capacity of Eagle Eye's booster. It's too bad. Earth and Mars are really badly positioned. Heck, it's almost easier to... He stopped typing. Furrowing his brow, he stared into the distance. He said. Grabbing his coffee cup, he went to the break room for a refill.
I know you're all busy, Teddy said, so let's make this fast. I need status on Project Iris from all departments. Venkat, let's start with you.
The mission team's ready, Venkat said. There was a minor turf war between the Ares 3 and Ares 4 pre-supply control teams. The Ares 3 guys said they should run it, cause while Watney's on Mars, Ares 3 is still in progress. The Ares 4 team points out it's their co-opted probe in the first place. I ended up going with Ares 3.
Did that upset Ares 4? Teddy asked.
Yeah, but they'll get over it. They have 13 pre-supply missions coming up. They won't have time to be pissy.
Mitch, Teddy said to the flight controller. What about the launch?
We've got a control room ready, Mitch replied. I'll oversee the launch, then hand crews and landing over to Venkat's guys.
Media, Teddy said, turning to Annie Montrose.
I'm giving daily updates to the press, she said. Everyone knows Watney's fucked if this doesn't work. The public hasn't been this engaged in ship construction since Apollo 11. CNN's The Watney Report has been the number one show in its time slot for the past 2 weeks.
The attention is good, Teddy said. It'll help get us emergency funding from Congress. Maurice, how's the booster?
It's all right for now, said Maurice Stein, director of pad operations. But it's not ideal. Eagle Eye 3 was set to launch. Boosters aren't designed to stand upright and bear the stress of gravity for long periods. We're adding external supports that we'll remove before launch. It's easier than disassembly. Also, the fuel is corrosive to the internal tanks, so we had to drain it. In the meantime, we're performing inspections on all systems every 3 days.
Good. Good. Teddy nodded. Now for the big question. Bruce, how's Iris coming along?
We're behind, Bruce said with a tired shake of his head. We're going as fast as we can, but it's just not fast enough.
I can find money for overtime, Teddy offered.
We're already working around the clock.
How far behind are we talking about? Teddy asked.
We've been at it 29 days, so we only have 19 left, Bruce explained. After that, the pad needs 13 days to mount it on the booster. We're at least 2 weeks behind.
Is that as far behind as you're going to get? Teddy asked. Or will you slip more?
Bruce shrugged. If we don't have any more problems, it'll be 2 weeks late. But we always have problems.
Give me a number, Teddy said.
15 days, Bruce responded. If I had another 15 days, I'm sure we could get it done in time.
All right, Teddy said. Let's create 15 days.
Turning his attention to the Ares 3 flight surgeon, Teddy asked, Dr. Keller, can we reduce Watney's food intake to make the rations last longer?
Sorry, but no, Keller said. He's already at a minimal calorie count. In fact, considering the amount of physical labor he does, he's eating far less than he should. And it's only going to get worse. Soon his entire diet will be potatoes and vitamin supplements. He's been saving protein-rich rations for later use, but he'll still be malnourished.
Once he runs out of food, how long until he starves to death? Teddy asked.
Presuming an ample water supply, he might last 3 weeks. Shorter than a typical hunger strike, but remember, he'll be malnourished and thin to begin with.
Remember, Venkat interjected, Iris is a tumbler. You might have to drive a few days to get it. And I'm guessing it's hard to control a rover when you're literally starving to death.
He's right, Dr. Keller confirmed. Within 4 days of running out of food, he'll barely be able to stand up, let alone control a rover. Plus, his mental faculties will rapidly decline. He'd have a hard time even staying awake.
So the landing date's firm, Teddy said. Maurice, can you get it on the booster in less than 13 days?
Maurice pondered.
Well, it only takes 3 days to actually mount it, and the following 10 are for testing and inspections.
How much can you reduce those?
With enough overtime, I could get the mounting down to 2 days. That includes transport from Pasadena to Cape Canaveral, but the inspections can't be shortened. They're time-based.
We do checks and rechecks with set intervals between them to see if something deforms or warps. If you shorten the intervals, you invalidate the inspections.
How often do those inspections reveal a problem? Teddy asked.
A silence fell over the room.
Maurice stammered.
Are you suggesting we don't do the inspections?
No, said Teddy. Right now I'm asking how often they reveal a problem.
About 1 in 20 launches.
And how often is the problem they reveal a would-be mission failure?
I'm not sure, maybe half the time?
So if we skip the inspections and testing, we have a 1 in 40 chance of mission failure? Teddy asked.
That's 2.5%, Venkat said, stepping in. Normally that's grounds for a countdown halt. We can't take a chance like that.
Normally was a long time ago, Teddy said calmly. 97.5% is better than zero. Can anyone think of a safer way to get more time? He looked around the table. Blank faces stared back.
All right, then. Speeding up the mounting process and skipping inspections buys us 11 days. If Bruce can pull a rabbit out of a hat and get done sooner, Maurice can do some inspections.
What about the other 4 days?
Venkat asked, still frowning at skipping inspections.
I'm sure Watney can stretch the food to last 4 extra days, malnutrition notwithstanding, Teddy said, looking to Dr. Keller.
Keller started. I can't recommend...
Folks, Teddy interrupted. I understand your position. We have procedures. Skipping those procedures means risk. Risk means trouble for your department, but now isn't the time to cover our asses. We have to take risks, or Mark Watney dies.
Turning to Keller, he said, make the food last another 4 days.
Keller nodded silently.
Rich, said Mike.
Rich Purnell concentrated on his computer screen. His cubicle was a landfill of printouts, charts, and reference books. Empty coffee cups rested on every surface. Takeout packaging littered the ground.
Rich, Mike said more forcefully.
Rich looked up.
Yeah. What the hell are you doing?
Just a little side project, something I wanted to check up on.
Well, that's fine, I guess, Mike said. But you need to do your assigned work first. I asked for those satellite adjustments 2 weeks ago, and you still haven't done them.
I need some supercomputer time, Rich said.
You need supercomputer time to calculate routine satellite adjustments?
No, it's for this other thing I'm working on, Rich said.
Rich, seriously, you have to do your job.
Rich thought for a moment.
Would now be a good time for a vacation? He asked.
Mike sighed.
You know what, Rich? I think now would be an ideal time for you to take a vacation.
Great, Rich smiled. I'll start right now.
Sure, Mike said. Go on home, get some rest.
Oh, I'm not going home, said Rich, returning to his calculations.
Mike rubbed his eyes.
Okay, whatever. About those satellite orbits.
I'm on vacation, Rich said without looking up.
Mike shrugged and walked away.
0800 hours, 1 minute. Watney. How's my care package coming along? 0800 hours, 16 minutes. JPL. A little behind schedule, but we'll get it done. In the meantime, we want you to get back to work. We're satisfied the HAB is in good condition. Maintenance only takes you 12 hours per week. We're going to pack the rest of your time with research and experiments.
0800 hours, 31 minutes. Watney.
Great. I'm sick of sitting on my ass. I'm going to be here for years. You may as well make use of me.
0800 hours, 47 minutes. JPL.
That's what we're thinking.
We'll get you a schedule as soon as the science team puts it together. It'll be mostly of EVAs, geological samples, soil tests, and weekly self-administered medical tests. Honestly, this is the best bonus Mars time we've had since the Opportunity Lander.
0900 hours, 2 minutes. Watney.
Opportunity never went back to Earth.
0900 hours, 17 minutes. JPL.
Sorry. Bad analogy.
The White Room was abuzz with activity as technicians sealed Iris into the specially designed shipping container. The other two shifts watched from the observation deck.
They had rarely seen their own homes in 2 months. A makeshift bunk room had been set up in the cafeteria. Fully a third of them would normally be asleep at this hour, but they did not want to miss this moment. The shift leader tightened the final bolt. As he retracted the wrench, the engineers broke into applause. Many of them were in tears. After 62 days of grueling work, Iris was complete. "The launch preparations are complete," Annie Montrose said to the press room. "Iris is ready to go. The scheduled launch is 9:14 a.m. Once launched, it will stay in orbit for at least 3 hours. During that time, Mission Control will gather exact telemetry in preparation for the Transmars injection burn. Once that's complete, the mission will be handed off to the Ares III pre-supply team, who will monitor its progress over the following months. It will take 414 days to reach Mars."
"About the payload?" a reporter asked. "I hear there's more than just food."
"That's true," Annie smiled. "We allocated 100 grams for luxury items. There are some handwritten letters from Mark's family, a note from the president, and a USB drive filled with music from all ages."
"Any disco?"
someone asked. "No disco," Annie said, as chuckles cascaded through the room. CNN's Kathy Warner spoke up. "If this launch fails, is there any recourse for Watney?" "There are risks to any launch," Annie said, "but we don't anticipate problems. The weather at the Cape is clear with warm temperatures. Conditions couldn't be better."
"Is there any spending limit to this rescue operation?" another reporter asked. "Some people are beginning to ask how much is too much."
"It's not about the bottom line," Annie said, prepared for the question. "It's about a human life in immediate danger. But if you want to look at it financially, consider the value of Mark Watney's extended mission. His prolonged mission and fight for survival is giving us more knowledge about Mars than the rest of the Ares program combined."
"Do you believe in God, Venkat?" Mitch asked.
"Sure, lots of them," Venkat said. "I'm Hindu."
"Ask them all for help with this launch."
"Will do."
Mitch stepped forward to his station in the large control room. He glanced at the many screens on the far wall and the dozens of people at their stations. He put his headset on and said,
"This is the flight director. Begin launch status check."
"Roger that, Houston,"
came the reply from the launch control director in Florida.
"CLCDR checking all stations are manned and systems ready," he broadcast. "Give me a go, no go for launch. Talker?"
"Go,"
came the response.
"Timer?"
"Go,"
came another voice.
"QAM-1.
"Go."
Resting his chin on his hands, Mitch stared at the center screen. It showed the pad video feed. The booster, amid cloudy water vapor from the cooling process, still had Eagle Eye 3 stenciled on the side.
"QAM-2.
"Go."
"QAM-3.
"Go."
Venkat leaned against the back wall. An administrator, his job was done. He could only watch and hope. His gaze fixated on the far wall's displays. In his mind, he saw the numbers, the shift juggling, the outright lies and borderline crimes he'd committed to put this mission together. It would all be worthwhile if it worked.
"FSC?"
"Go."
"Prop 1.
"Go."
Teddy sat in the VIP observation room behind Mission Control. His authority offered him the very best seat. Front row center. His briefcase lay at his feet, and he held a blue folder in his hands.
"Prop 2.
"Go."
"PTO.
"Go."
Annie Montrose paced in her private office next to the press room. 9 televisions mounted to the wall were each tuned to a different network. Each network showed the launch pad. A glance at her computer showed foreign networks doing the same. The world was holding its breath.
"ACC.
"Go."
"LWO?
"Go."
Bruce Ng sat at the JPL cafeteria along with hundreds of engineers who had given everything they had to Iris. They watched the large TV with rapt attention. It was 6:13 a.m. in Pasadena, yet every single employee was present.
"AFLC.
"Go."
"Guidance.
"Go."
Millions of kilometers away, the crew of Hermes listened as they crowded around Johansson's station. The 2-minute transmission time didn't matter. They had no way to help. There was no need to interact. Johansson stared intently at her screen, which displayed only the audio signal strength. Beck wrung his hands. Vogel stood motionless, his eyes fixed on the floor. Martinez prayed silently at first, then saw no reason to hide it. Commander Lewis stood apart, her arms folded across her chest.
PTC?
Go.
Launch Vehicle Director?
Go.
Houston, this is Launch Control. We are go for launch.
Roger, Mitch said, checking the countdown. This is flight. We are go for launch on schedule.
Roger that, Houston, Launch Control said. Launch on schedule.
Once the clock reached negative 15 seconds, the television networks got what they were waiting for. The timer controller began the verbal countdown.
15, she said. 14. 13. 12. 11.
Thousands had gathered at Cape Canaveral, the largest crowd ever to watch an unmanned launch. They listened to the timer control's voice as it echoed across the grandstands.
10. 9. 8. 7.
Rich Purnell, entrenched in his orbital calculations, had lost track of time. He didn't notice when his co-workers migrated to the large meeting room where a TV had been set up. In the back of his mind, he thought the office was unusually quiet, but he gave it no further thought.
6. 5. 4.
Ignition sequence start.
3. 2. 1.
Clamps released. The booster rose amid a plume of smoke and fire, slowly at first, then racing ever faster. The assembled crowd cheered it on its way.
And liftoff of the Iris supply probe, the timer controller said.
As the booster soared, Mitch had no time to watch the spectacle on the main screen.
Trim, he called out.
Trim's good, flight, came the immediate response.
Course,
he asked.
On course. Altitude 1,000 meters, someone said.
We've reached safe abort,
another person called out, indicating that the ship could crash harmlessly into the Atlantic Ocean if necessary.
Altitude 1,500 meters.
Pitch and roll maneuver commencing.
Getting a little shimmy, flight.
Mitch looked over to the ascent flight director.
Say again?
A slight shimmy. Onboard guidance is handling it.
Keep an eye on it, Mitch said.
Altitude 2,500 meters.
Pitch and roll complete. 22 seconds till staging.
The quick yet thorough design of Iris accounted for catastrophic landing failure. Rather than normal meal kits, most of the food was cubed protein bar material. Even if Iris failed to deploy its tumble balloons and impacted at hundreds of kilometers per hour, the protein cubes would still be edible. An unmanned mission, there was no cap on acceleration. The contents of the probe endured forces no human could survive. While NASA had tested the effects of extreme G-forces on protein cubes, they had not done so with a simultaneous lateral vibration. Had they been given more time, they would have. The harmless shimmy, caused by a minor fuel mixture imbalance, rattled the payload. Mounted by strong bolts, Iris held firm. The protein cubes inside did not. The thrust compressed the food while the shimmy rattled it. An effect similar to liquefaction during an earthquake transformed the protein cubes into a thick sludge. Stored in a compartment that originally had no leftover space, the now compressed substance had room to slosh. The shimmy also caused an imbalanced load, forcing the sludge toward the edge of its compartment. The shift in weight only aggravated the problem, and the shimmy grew stronger.
"Shimmy's getting violent," reported the ascent flight director.
"How violent?" Mitch said.
"More than we like," he said. "But the accelerometers caught it and calculated the new center of mass. The guidance computer is adjusting the engine's thrust to counteract. We're still good."
"Keep me posted," Mitch said.
13 seconds till staging."
The unexpected weight shift had not spelled disaster. All systems were designed for worst-case scenarios. Each did their job admirably. The ship continued toward orbit with only a minor course adjustment, implemented automatically by sophisticated software. The first stage depleted its fuel, and the booster coasted for a fraction of a second as it jettisoned stage clamps via explosive bolts. The now empty stage fell away from the craft as the second stage engines prepared to ignite. The brutal forces had disappeared. The protein sludge floated free in the container. Given 2 seconds, it would have re-expanded and solidified,
but it was given only a quarter second. As the second stage fired, the craft experienced a sudden jolt of immense force. No longer contending with the dead weight of the first stage, the acceleration was profound. The 300 kilograms of sludge slammed into the back of its container. The point of impact was at the edge of Iris, nowhere near where the mass was expected to be. Though Iris was held in place by five large bolts, the force was directed entirely to a single one. The bolt was designed to withstand immense forces, if necessary, to carry the entire weight of the payload, but it was not designed to sustain a sudden impact from a loose 300-kilogram mass. The bolt sheared. The burden was then shifted to the remaining four bolts. The forceful impact having passed, their work was considerably easier than that of their fallen comrade. Had the pad crew been given time to do normal inspections, they would have noticed the minor defect in one of the bolts, a defect that slightly weakened it, though would not cause failure on a normal mission. Still, they would have swapped it out with a perfect replacement. The off-center load presented unequal force to the four remaining bolts, the defective one bearing the brunt of it. Soon, it failed as well. From there, the other three failed in rapid succession. Iris slipped from its supports in the payload bulb, slamming into the hull.
"Whoa!" exclaimed the ascent flight director. "Flight, we're getting a large procession." "What?" Mitch said as alerts beeped and lights flashed across all the consoles.
"Force on Iris is at 7 G's, someone said.
"Intermittent signal loss," came another voice.
"Ascent, what's happening here?" Mitch demanded. "All hell broke loose. It's spinning on the long axis with a 17-degree precession."
"How bad?"
"At least 5 RPS and falling off course."
"Can you get it to orbit?"
"I can't talk to it at all. Signal failures left and right."
"Calm,"
Mitch shot to the communications director.
"Working on it, flight," came the response. "There's a problem with the onboard system."
"Getting some major G's inside, flight. Ground telemetry shows it 200 meters low of target path. We've lost readings on the probe, flight."
Mitch zeroed in on that last comment.
"Entirely lost the probe?" Mitch asked.
"Affirm, flight. Intermittent signal from the ship, but no probe."
"Shit," Mitch said. "It shook loose in the bay."
"It's dreidling, flight."
"Can it limp to orbit?" Mitch said. "Even super low EO? We might be able to..."
"Loss of signal, flight. LOS here, too."
"Same here."
Other than the alarms, the room fell silent. After a moment, Mitch said,
"Reestablish?"
"No luck," said Com.
"Ground?"
Mitch asked.
"GC," came the reply. "Vehicle had already left visual range."
"SATCON?"
Mitch asked.
"No satellite acquisition of signal."
Mitch looked forward to the main screen. It was black now, with large white letters reading LOS.
"Flight," came a voice over the radio. "U.S. destroyer Stockton reports debris falling from the sky. Source matches last known location of Iris."
Mitch put his head in his hands.
"Roger," he said.
Then he uttered the words every flight director hopes never to say.
"GC, flight, lock the doors."
It was the signal to start post-failure procedures. From the VIP observation room, Teddy watched the despondent mission control center. He took a deep breath, then let it out. He looked forlornly at the blue folder, which contained the cheerful speech praising a perfect launch. Placing it in his briefcase, he then extracted the red folder with the other speech in it. Venkat sat in his darkened office. He never decided to be in the dark. He'd just been lost in thought so long it got dark around him. His mobile rang. His wife again. No doubt worried about him. He let it go to voicemail. He just couldn't face her or anyone. A brief chime came from his computer. Glancing over, he saw an email from JPL. A relayed message from Pathfinder. 1600 hours, 3 minutes. Watney. How'd the launch go?
Chapter 16. Martinez. Dr. Shields says I need to write personal messages to each of the crew. She says it'll keep me tethered to humanity. I think it's bullshit, but hey, it's an order. With you, I can be blunt. If I die, I need you to check on my parents. They'll want to hear about our time on Mars firsthand. I'll need you to do that.
It won't be easy talking to a couple about their dead son. It's a lot to ask, that's why I'm asking you. I'd tell you you're my best friend and stuff, but it would be gay. I'm not giving up, just planning for every outcome. It's what I do.
Guo Ming, director of the China National Space Administration, examined the expansive paperwork at his desk. In the old days, when China wanted to launch a rocket, they just launched it. Now they were compelled by international agreements to warn other nations first. It was a requirement, Guo Ming noted to himself, that did not apply to the United States. To be fair, the Americans publicly announced their launch schedules well in advance, so it amounted to the same. He walked a fine line, filling out the form. Making the launch date and flight path clear while doing everything possible to conceal state secrets. He snorted at the last requirement.
Ridiculous, he mumbled.
The Taiyang Shen had no strategic or military value. It was an unmanned probe that would be in Earth orbit less than 2 days. After that, it would travel to a solar orbit between Mercury and Venus. It would be China's first heliology probe to orbit the sun. Yet, the State Council insisted all launches be shrouded in secrecy, even launches with nothing to hide. This way, other nations could not infer from lack of openness which launches contained classified payloads. A knock at the door interrupted his paperwork.
Come, Guo Ming said, happy for the interruption.
Good evening, sir, said Under Director Zhu Tao.
Tao, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be back in Beijing.
How were things in Zhuquan? Asked Guo Ming. Not too cold, I hope. I'll never understand why our launch complex is in the middle of the Gobi Desert.
It was cold, yet manageable, Zhu Tao said.
And how are launch preparations coming along?
I am happy to report they are all on schedule.
Excellent, Guo Ming smiled.
Zhu Tao sat quietly staring at his boss. Guo Ming looked expectantly back at him, but Zhu Tao neither stood to leave nor said anything further.
Something else, Tao? Guo Ming asked.
Zhu Tao said. Of course, you've heard about the Iris probe.
Yes, I did, Guo frowned. Terrible situation. That poor man's going to starve.
Possibly, Zhu Tao said. Possibly not.
Guo Ming leaned back in his chair.
What are you saying?
It's the Taiyang Shen's booster, sir. Our engineers have run the numbers, and it has enough fuel for a Mars injection orbit. It could get there in 419 days.
Are you kidding?
Have you ever known me to kid, sir?
Guo Ming stood and pinched his chin. Pacing, he said,
We can really send a probe to Mars?
It's hardly notable, sir, Zhu Tao said. We've sent several in the past.
Yes, I know. But we could really send the Taiyang Shen?
No, sir, said Zhu Tao. It's far too heavy. The massive heat shielding makes it the heaviest unmanned probe we've ever built. That's why the booster had to be so powerful. But a lighter payload could be sent all the way to Mars.
How much mass could we send?
Guo Ming asked.
941 kilograms, sir.
Guo Ming said. I bet NASA could work with that limitation. Why haven't they approached us?
Because they don't know, Zhu Tao said. All our booster technology is classified information. The Ministry of State Security even spreads disinformation about our capabilities. This is for obvious reasons.
So they don't know we can help them, Guo Ming said. If we decide not to help, no one will know we could have.
Correct, sir. For the sake of our argument, let's say we decided to help. What then?
Time would be the enemy, sir, Zhu Tao answered.
Based on the travel duration and the supplies their astronaut has remaining, any such probe would have to be launched within a month. Even then he would starve a little.
That's right around when we plan to launch Taiyang Shen.
Yes, sir, but it took them 2 months to build Iris, and it was so rushed it failed.
That's their problem, Guo Ming said. Our end would be providing the booster,
We'd launch from Jiquan. We can't ship an 800-ton rocket to Florida.
Any agreement would hinge on the Americans reimbursing us for the booster, Zhu Tao said. And the State Council would likely want political favors from the U.S. government.
Reimbursement would be pointless, Guo Ming said. This was an expensive project, and the State Council grumbled about it all along. If they had a bulk payout for its value, they'd just keep it. We'd never get to build another one.
He clasped his hands behind his back.
And the American people may be sentimental, but their government is not. The U.S. State Department won't trade anything major for one man's life.
So it's hopeless? Asked Zhu Tao.
Not hopeless, Guo Ming corrected. Just hard. If this becomes a negotiation by diplomats, it will never resolve. We need to keep this among scientists. Space agency to space agency. I'll get a translator and call NASA's director. We'll work out an agreement, then present it to our governments as a fait accompli.
But what can they do for us? Zhu Tao asked. We'd be giving up a booster and effectively canceling Taiyang Shen.
Guo Ming smiled.
They'll give us something we can't get without them.
And that is?
They'll put a Chinese astronaut on Mars.
Zhu Tao stood.
Of course, he smiled. The Ares V crew hasn't even been selected yet. We'll insist on a crewman. One we get to pick and train. NASA and the U.S. State Department would surely accept that. But will our State Council?
Guo Ming smiled wryly.
Publicly rescue the Americans? Put a Chinese astronaut on Mars? Have the world see China is equal to the U.S. in space? The State Council would sell their own mothers for that.
Teddy listened to the phone at his ear. The voice on the other end finished what it had to say, then fell silent as it awaited an answer. He stared at nothing in particular as he processed what he'd just heard. After a few seconds, he replied,
"Yes."
"Johansson, your poster outsold the rest of ours combined. You're a hot chick who went to Mars. You're on dorm room walls all over the world. Looking like that, why are you such a nerd? And you are, you know, a serious nerd. I had to do some computer shit to get Pathfinder talking to the rover, and oh my God. And I had NASA telling me what to do every step of the way. You should try to be more cool. Wear dark glasses and a leather jacket. Carry a switchblade. Aspire to a level of coolness known only as botanist cool. Did you know Commander Lewis had a chat with us men? If anyone hit on you, we'd be off the mission. I guess after a lifetime of commanding sailors, she's got an unfairly jaded view. Anyway, try not to think about all those guys wanking to your poster."
"Okay, here we are again," said Bruce to the assembled heads of JPL. "You've all heard about the Taiyang Shen, so you know our friends in China have given us one more chance. But this time it's going to be harder. Taiyang Shen will be ready to launch in 28 days. If it launches on time, our payload will get to Mars on Sol 624, 6 weeks after Watney's expected to run out of food. NASA's already working on ways to stretch his supply. We made history when we finished Iris in 63 days. Now we have to do it in 28.
He looked across the table to the incredulous faces.
"Folks," he said, "this is going to be the most ghetto spacecraft ever built. There's only one way to finish that fast. No landing system."
"Sorry, what?"
Jack Trevor stammered. Bruce nodded.
"You heard me, no landing system. We'll need guidance for in-flight course adjustments, but once it gets to Mars, it's going to crash."
"That's crazy," Jack said. "It'll be going an insane velocity when it hits."
"Yup," Bruce said. "With ideal atmospheric drag, it'll impact at 300 meters per second.
"What good will a pulverized probe do, Watney?" Jack asked.
"As long as the food doesn't burn up on the way in, Watney can eat it," Bruce commented.
Turning to the whiteboard, he began drawing a basic organizational chart.
"I want two teams," he began. "Team one,
We'll make the outer shell, guidance system, and thrusters. All we need is for it to get to Mars. I want the safest possible system. Aerosol propellant would be best. High-gain radio so we can talk to it, and standard satellite navigational software. Team 2 will deal with the payload. They need to find a way to contain the food during impact. If protein bars hit sand at 300 meters a second, they'll make protein-scented sand. We need them edible after impact. We can weigh 941 kilograms. At least 300 of that needs to be food. Get cracking.
Dr. Kapoor, Ritz said, peeking his head into Venkat's office. Do you have a minute?
Venkat gestured him in.
You are...
Rich Purnell, he said, shuffling into the office, his arms wrapped around a sheaf of disorganized papers.
From Astrodynamics.
Nice to meet you, Venkat said.
What can I do for you, Rich?
I came up with something a while ago, spent a lot of time on it. He dumped the papers on Venkat's desk. Let me find the summary. Venkat stared forlornly at his once clean desk, now strewn with scores of printouts.
Here we go,
Rich said triumphantly, grabbing a paper. Then his expression saddened.
Nah, this isn't it.
Rich, Venkat said, maybe you should just tell me what this is about. Rich looked at the mess of papers and sighed.
But I had such a cool summary.
A summary for what?
How to save Watney.
Well, it's already in progress, Venkat said.
It's a last-ditch effort, but...
The Taiyang Shen? Rich snorted. That won't work. You can't make a Mars probe in a month.
We're sure as hell going to try, Venkat said, a note of annoyance in his voice.
Oh, sorry, am I being difficult? Rich asked. I'm not good with people. Sometimes I'm difficult. I wish people would just tell me. Anyway, the Taiyang Shen is critical. In fact, my idea won't work without it. But a Mars probe? Come on.
All right, Venkat said. What's your idea?
Rich snatched a paper from the desk.
Here it is.
He handed it to Venkat with a childlike smile. Venkat took the summary and skimmed it. The more he read, the wider his eyes got.
Are you sure about this?
Absolutely, Rich beamed.
Have you told anyone else?
Who would I tell?
I don't know, Venkat said.
Friends? I don't have any of those.
Okay, keep it under your hat, Venkat said.
I don't wear a hat.
It's just an expression.
Really? Rich said. It's a stupid expression.
Rich, you're being difficult.
Ah, thanks.
Vogel, being your backup has backfired. I guess NASA figured botany and chemistry are similar because they both end in Y. One way or another, I ended up being your backup chemist. Remember when they made you spend a day explaining your experiments to me? It was in the middle of intense mission prep. You may have forgotten. You started my training by buying me a beer for breakfast. Germans are awesome. Anyway, now that I have time to kill, NASA gave me a pile of work, and all of your chemistry crap is on the list. So now I have to do boring-ass experiments with test tubes and soil and pH levels and My life is now a desperate struggle for survival, with occasional titration. Frankly, I suspect you're a supervillain. You're a chemist. You have a German accent. You had a base on Mars. What more can there be?
What the fuck is Project Elrond? Annie asked.
I had to make something up, Venkat said.
So you came up with Elrond? Annie pressed.
Because it's a secret meeting? Mitch guessed. The email said I couldn't even tell my assistant.
I'll explain everything once Teddy arrives, Venkat said. Why does Elrond mean secret meeting? Annie asked.
Are we going to make a momentous decision? Bruce Ng asked.
Exactly, Venkat said.
How did you know that? Annie asked, getting annoyed.
Elrond, Bruce said. The Council of Elrond from Lord of the Rings. It's the meeting where they decide to destroy the One Ring.
Jesus, Annie said. None of you got laid in high school, did you?
Good morning, Teddy said as he walked in.
Seating himself, he rested his hands on the table.
Anyone know what this meeting's about? He asked.
Wait, Mitch said. Teddy doesn't even know?
Venkat took a deep breath.
One of our astrodynamicists, Rich Purnell, has found a way to get Hermes back to Mars. The course he came up with would give Hermes a Mars flyby on Sol 549.
Silence. You shitting us? Annie demanded.
Sol 549. How's that even possible? Asked Bruce.
Even Iris wouldn't have landed till Sol 588.
Iris was a point thrust craft, Venkat said. Hermes has a constant thrust ion engine. It's always accelerating. Also, Hermes has a lot of velocity right now. On their current Earth intercept course, they have to decelerate for the next month just to slow down to Earth speed.
Mitch rubbed the back of his head.
Wow, 549, that's 35 sols before Watney runs out of food. That would solve everything.
Teddy leaned forward.
Run us through it, Venkat. What would it entail?
Well, Venkat began, if they did this Rich Purnell maneuver, they'd start accelerating right away to preserve their velocity and gain even more. They wouldn't intercept Earth at all, but would come close enough to use a gravity assist to adjust course. Around that time, they'd pick up a resupply probe with provisions for the extended trip. After that, they'd be on an accelerating orbit towards Mars, arriving on Sol 549. Like I said, it's a Mars flyby. This isn't anything like a normal Ares mission. They'll be going too fast to fall into orbit. The rest of the maneuver takes them back to Earth. They'd be home 211 days after the flyby.
What good is a flyby? Bruce asked.
They don't have any way to get Watney off the surface.
Yeah, Venkat said.
Now for the unpleasant part. Watney would have to get to the Ares 4 MAV.
Schiaparelli crater? Mitch gaped. That's 3,200 kilometers away.
3,235 kilometers, to be exact, Venkat said. It's not out of the question. He drove to Pathfinder's landing site and back. That's over 1,500 kilometers.
That was over flat desert terrain, Bruce chimed in.
But the trip to Schiaparelli, suffice it to say, Venkat interrupted, it would be very difficult and dangerous, but we have a lot of clever scientists to help him trick out the rover. Also, there would be MAV modifications.
What's wrong with the MAV? Mitch asked.
It's designed to get to low Mars orbit, Venkat explained. But Hermes would be on a flyby, so the MAV would have to escape Mars gravity entirely to intercept.
How? Mitch asked.
It would have to lose weight. A lot of weight. I can get rooms full of people working on these problems if we decide to do this.
Earlier, Teddy said, you mentioned a supply probe for Hermes. We have that capability?
Yes, with the Taiyang Shen, Venkat said. We'd shoot for a near-Earth rendezvous. It's a lot easier than getting a probe to Mars, that's for sure.
I see, Teddy said. So we have two options on the table. Send Watney enough food to last until Ares 4, or send Hermes back to get him right now. Both plans require the Taiyang Shen, so we can only do one.
Yes, Venkat said. We'll have to pick one.
They all took a moment to consider.
What about the Hermes crew? Annie asked, breaking the silence. Would they have a problem with adding, she did some quick math in her head, 533 days to their mission?
They wouldn't hesitate, Mitch said. Not for a second. That's why Venkat called this meeting.
He cast a disapproving glare at Venkat.
He wants us to decide instead.
That's right, Venkat said.
It should be Commander Lewis's call, Mitch said sternly.
Pointless to even ask her, Venkat said. We need to make this decision. It's a matter of life and death.
She's the mission commander, Mitch said. Life and death decisions are her damn job.
Easy, Mitch, Teddy said.
Bullshit, Mitch said. You guys have done end runs around the crew every time something goes wrong. You didn't tell them Watney was still alive. Now you're not telling them there's a rescue option.
We already have a rescue option, Teddy said. We're just discussing another one.
The crash lander? Mitch said. Does anyone think that'll work? Anyone?
All right, Mitch, Teddy said. You've expressed your opinion and we've heard it. Let's move on.
He turned to Venkat. Can Hermes function for 533 days beyond the scheduled mission end?
It should, Venkat said. The crew may have to fix things here and there, but they're well trained. Remember, Hermes was made to do all five Ares missions. It's only halfway through its designed lifespan.
It's the most expensive thing ever built, Teddy said. We can't make another one. If something went wrong, the crew would die and the Ares program with them.
Losing the crew would be a disaster, Venkat said.
but we wouldn't lose Hermes. We can remotely operate it. So long as the reactor and ion engines continue to work, we could bring it back.
Space travel is dangerous, Mitch said. We can't make this a discussion about what's safest.
I disagree, Teddy said. This is absolutely a discussion about what's safest, and about how many lives are at stake. Both plans are risky, but resupplying Watney only risks one life, while the Rich Purnell maneuver risks six.
Consider degree of risk, Teddy, Venkat said. Mitch is right. The crash lander is high risk. It could miss Mars, it could re-enter wrong and burn up, it could crash too hard and destroy the food. We estimate 30% chance of success.
A near-Earth rendezvous with Hermes is more doable? Teddy asked.
Much more doable, Venkat confirmed. With sub-second transmission delays, we can control the probe directly from Earth rather than rely on automated systems. When the time comes to dock, Major Martinez can pilot it remotely from Hermes with no transmission delay at all. And Hermes has a human crew able to overcome any hiccups that may happen. And we don't have to do a re-entry. The supplies don't have to survive a 300 meter per second impact. So, Bruce offered, we can have a high chance of killing one person or a low chance of killing six people. Jeez, how do we even make this decision?
We talk about it, then Teddy makes the decision, Venkat said. Not sure what else we can do.
We could let Lewis, Mitch began.
Yeah, other than that, Venkat interrupted.
Question, Annie said. What am I even here for? This seems like something for you nerds to discuss.
You need to be in the loop, Venkat said. We're not deciding right now. We'll need to quietly research the details internally. Something might leak, and you need to be ready to dance around questions.
How long have we got to make a decision? Teddy asked.
The window for starting the maneuver ends in 39 hours.
All right, Teddy said. Everyone, we discuss this only in person or on the phone, never email, and don't talk to anyone about this other than the people here. The last thing we need is public opinion pressing for a risky cowboy rescue that may be impossible.
Beck. Hey, man, how you been? Now that I'm in a dire situation, I don't have to follow social rules anymore. I can be honest with everyone.
Bearing that in mind, I have to say, dude, you need to tell Johansson how you feel. If you don't, you'll regret it forever.
I won't lie. It could end badly. I have no idea what she thinks of you or of anything. She's weird. But wait till the mission's over. You're on a ship with her for another 2 months. Also, if you guys got up to anything while the mission was in progress, Lewis would kill you.
Venkat, Mitch, Annie, Bruce, and Teddy met secretly for the second time in as many days. Project Elrond had taken on a dark connotation, veiled in secrecy. Many people knew the name. None knew its purpose. Speculation ran rampant. Some thought it was a completely new program in the works. Others worried it might be a move to cancel Ares 4 and 5. Most thought it was Ares 6 in the works.
It wasn't an easy decision, Teddy said to the assembled elite. But I've decided to go with Iris 2. No Rich Purnell maneuver.
Mitch slammed his fist on the table.
We'll do all we can to make it work, Bruce said.
If it's not too much to ask, Venkat began. What made up your mind?
Teddy sighed.
It's a matter of risk, he said. Iris 2 only risks one life. Rich Purnell risks all six of them. I know Rich Purnell is more likely to work, but I don't think it's six times more likely.
You fucking coward, Mitch said.
Mitch, Venkat said.
You goddamned fucking coward, Mitch continued, ignoring Venkat.
You just want to cut your losses. You're on damage control. You don't give a shit about Watney's life.
Of course I do, Teddy replied. And I'm sick of your infantile attitude. You can throw all the tantrums you want, but the rest of us have to be adults. This isn't a TV show. The riskier solution isn't always the best.
Space is dangerous, Mitch snapped. It's what we do here. If you want to play it safe all the time, go join an insurance company. And by the way, it's not even your life you're risking. The crew can make up their own minds about it.
No, they can't, Teddy fired back. They're too emotionally involved. Clearly, so are you. I'm not gambling five lives to save one, especially when we might save him without risking them at all.
Bullshit, Mitch shot back as he stood from his chair.
You're just convincing yourself the crash lander will work so you don't have to take a risk. You're hanging him out to dry, you chicken shit son of a bitch.
He stormed out of the room, slamming the door behind him. After a few seconds, Venkat followed behind, saying, I'll make sure he cools off. Bruce slumped in his chair.
Sheesh, he said nervously. We're scientists, for Christ's sake. What the hell?
Annie quietly gathered her things and placed them in her briefcase. Teddy looked to her.
Sorry about that, Annie, he said. What can I say? Sometimes men let testosterone take over.
I was hoping he'd kick your ass, she interrupted.
What?
I know you care about the astronauts, but he's right. You are a fucking coward. If you had balls, we might be able to save Watney.
Lewis. Hi, Commander. Between training and our trip to Mars, I spent 2 years working with you. I think I know you pretty well, so I'm guessing you blame yourself for my situation.
Don't. You were faced with an impossible scenario and made a tough decision. That's what commanders do. And your decision was right. If you'd waited any longer, the MAV would have tipped. I'm sure you've run through all the possible outcomes in your head, so you know there's nothing you could have done differently, other than be psychic. You probably think losing a crewman is the worst thing that can happen. Not true. Losing the whole crew is worse. You kept that from happening. But there's something more important we need to discuss. What is it with you and Disco? I can understand the 70s TV because everyone loves hairy people with huge collars, but Disco? Disco?
Vogel checked the position and orientation of Hermes against the projected path. It matched, as usual. In addition to being the mission's chemist, he was also an accomplished astrophysicist, though his duties as navigator were laughably easy. The computer knew the course. It knew when to angle the ship so the ion engines would be aimed correctly, and it knew the location of the ship at all times, easily calculated from the position of the sun and Earth, and knowing the exact time from an onboard atomic clock. Barring a complete computer failure or other critical event, Vogel's vast knowledge of astrodynamics would never come into play. Completing the check, he ran a diagnostic on the engines. They were functioning at peak. He did all this from his quarters. All onboard computers could control all ship's functions. Gone were the days of physically visiting the engines to check up on them. Having completed his work for the day, he finally had time to read email. Sorting through the messages NASA deemed worthy to upload, he read the most interesting first and responded when necessary. His responses were cached and would be sent to Earth with Johansson's next uplink. A message from his wife caught his attention, titled, Unsere Kinder, Our Children. It contained nothing but an image attachment. He raised an eyebrow. Several things stood out at once. Firstly, Kinder should have been capitalized. Helena, a grammar school teacher in Bremen, was very unlikely to make that mistake. Also, to each other, they affectionately called their kids the Affen. Attempting to open the image, his viewer reported the file was unreadable. He walked down the narrow hallway. The crew quarters stood against the outer hull of the constantly spinning ship to maximize simulated gravity. Johansson's door was open as usual.
Johansson, good evening, Vogel said.
The crew kept the same sleep schedule, and it was nearing bedtime.
Oh, hello,
Johansson said, looking up from her computer.
I have the computer problem, Vogel explained. I wonder if you will help. Sure, she said. You are in the personal time, Vogel said. Perhaps tomorrow when you are on the duty is better? Now's fine, she said. What's wrong? It is a file. It is an image, but my computer cannot view. Where's the file?
She asked, typing on her keyboard.
It is on my shared space. The name is kinder.jpg. Let's take a look, she said.
Her fingers flew over her keyboard as windows opened and closed on her screen. Definitely a bad JPEG header, she said. Probably mangled in the download. Let me look with a hex editor, see if we got anything at all. After a few minutes, she said, This isn't a JPEG, it's a plain ASC2 text file. Looks like... well, I don't know what it is. Looks like a bunch of math formulae. She gestured to the screen. Does any of this make sense to you? Vogel leaned in, looking at the text.
Yeah, he said. It is a course maneuver for Hermes. It says the name is Rich Purnell Maneuver.
What's that? Johansson asked.
I have not heard of this maneuver.
He looked at the tables.
It is complicated. Very complicated.
He froze.
Sol 549, he exclaimed. Mein Gott!
The Hermes crew enjoyed their scant personal time in an area called the Wreck. Consisting of a table and barely room to seat six, it ranked low in gravity priority. Its position amidships granted it a mere 0.2 gravity. Still, it was enough to keep everyone in their seats as they pondered what Vogel told them.
And then mission would conclude with Earth intercept 211 days later, he finished up.
Thank you, Vogel, Lewis said. She'd heard the explanation earlier when Vogel came to her, but Johansson, Martinez, and Beck were hearing it for the first time. She gave them a moment to digest.
Would this really work? Martinez asked. Yeah, Vogel nodded. I ran the numbers. They all check out. It is brilliant course. Amazing.
How would he get off Mars? Martinez asked. Lewis leaned forward. There was more in the message, she began. The maneuver is part of an overall idea NASA had to rescue Watney. We'd have to pick up a supply near Earth and he'd have to get to Ares IV's MAV.
Why all the cloak and dagger? Beck asked.
According to the message, Lewis explained, NASA rejected the idea. They'd rather take a big risk on Watney than a small risk on all of us. Whoever snuck it into Vogel's email obviously disagreed.
So, Martinez said, we're talking about going directly against NASA's decision?
Yes, Lewis confirmed. That's what we're talking about. If we do the maneuver, they'll have to send the supply ship or we'll die. We have the opportunity to force their hand.
Are we going to do it? Johansson asked.
They all looked to Lewis. I won't lie, she said. I'd sure as hell like to, but this isn't a normal decision. This is something NASA expressly rejected. We're talking about mutiny, and that's not a word I throw around lightly. She stood and paced slowly around the table. We'll only do it if we all agree, and before you answer, consider the consequences. If we mess up the supply rendezvous, we die. If we mess up the Earth gravity assist, we die. If we do everything perfectly, we add 533 days to our mission. 533 days of unplanned space travel where anything could go wrong. Maintenance will be a hassle. Something might break that we can't fix. If it's life critical, we die.
Sign me up, Martinez smiled.
Easy, cowboy, Lewis said. You and I are military. There's a good chance we'd be court-martialed when we got home. As for the rest of you, I guarantee they'll never send you up again. Martinez leaned against the wall, arms folded with a half-grin on his face. The rest silently considered what their commander had said.
If we do this, Vogel said, it would be over 1,000 days of space. This is enough space for a life. I do not need to return.
Sounds like Vogel's in, Martinez grinned.
Me too, obviously.
Let's do it, Beck said. If you think it'll work, Johansson said to Lewis, I trust you. Okay, Lewis said. If we go for it, what's involved? Vogel shrugged.
I plot the course and execute it, he said. What else?
Remote override, Johansson said. It's designed to get the ship back if we all die or something. They can take over Hermes from mission control.
But we're right here, Lewis said. We can undo whatever they try, right?
Not really, Johansson said. Remote override takes priority over any onboard controls. It assumes there's been a disaster and the ship's control panels can't be trusted.
Can you disable it? Lewis asked.
Johansson pondered. Hermes has four redundant flight computers, each connected to three redundant comm systems. If any computer gets signal from any comm system, mission control can take over. We can't shut down the comms. We'd lose telemetry and guidance. We can't shut down the computers. We need them to control the ship. I'll have to disable the remote override on each system. It's part of the OS. I'll have to jump over the code.
Yes, I can do it.
You're sure? Lewis asked. You can turn it off.
Shouldn't be hard, Johansson said. It's an emergency feature, not a security program. It isn't protected against malicious code.
Malicious code? Beck smiled.
So, you'll be a hacker?
Yeah, Johansson smiled back. I guess I will.
All right, Lewis said. Looks like we can do it. But I don't want peer pressure forcing anyone into it. We'll wait for 24 hours. During that time, anyone can change their mind. Just talk to me in private or send me an email. I'll call it off and never tell anyone who it was. Lewis stayed behind as the rest filed out. Watching them leave, she saw they were smiling, all four of them. For the first time since leaving Mars, they were back to their old selves. She knew right then no one would change their mind. They were going back to Mars. Everyone knew Brendan Hutch would be running missions soon. He rose through the ranks as fast as one could in the large, inertia-bound organization. Known as a diligent worker, his skill and leadership qualities were plain to all his subordinates. Brendan was in charge of mission control from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. every night. Continued excellent performance in his role would certainly net him a promotion. It was already announced he'd be backup flight controller for Ares 4, and he had a good shot at the top job for Ares 5.
"Flight, Capcom," came a voice through his headset.
"Go, Capcom," Brendan responded. Though they were in the same room, radio protocol was observed at all times.
"Unscheduled status update from Hermes."
With Hermes 90 light seconds away, back-and-forth voice communication was impractical. Other than media relations, Hermes would communicate via text until they were much closer.
"Roger," Brendan said. "Read it out."
I don't get it, Flight," came the confused reply. "No real status, just a single sentence."
"What's it say?"
"Message reads, Houston, be advised, Rich Purnell is a steely-eyed missile man."
"What?" Brendan asked. "Who the hell is Rich Purnell?"
"Flight, telemetry," came another voice.
"Go, telemetry," Brendan said.
"Hermes is off course."
"Capcom, advise Hermes they're drifting. Telemetry, get a correction vector ready."
"Negative, Flight," telemetry interrupted. "It's not drift, they adjusted course. Instrumentation uplink shows a deliberate 27.812 degree rotation."
"What the hell?" Brendan stammered.
"Capcom, ask them what the hell."
"Roger, Flight."
"Message sent. Minimum reply time, 3 minutes, 4 seconds.
"Telemetry, any chance this is instrumentation failure?"
"Negative, Flight. We're tracking them with SATCON. Observed position is consistent with the course change."
"Capcom, read your logs and see what the previous shift did. See if a massive course change was ordered and somehow nobody told us."
"Roger, Flight."
"Guidance, Flight," Brendan said.
"Go, Flight," came the reply from the guidance controller.
"Work out how long they can stay on this course before it's irreversible. At what point will they no longer be able to intercept Earth?" "Working on that now, Flight." "And somebody find out who the hell Rich Purnell is."
Mitch sat comfortably in Teddy's office.
"Why'd you do it, Mitch?" Teddy demanded.
"Do what?" Mitch asked.
"You know damn well what I'm talking about."
"Oh, you mean the Hermes mutiny?" Mitch said innocently. "You know, that'd make a good movie title. The Hermes mutiny. Got a nice ring to it."
"We know you did it," Ted said sternly. "We don't know how, but we know you sent the maneuver."
"I suppose you have proof, then."
Teddy glared.
"No, not yet, but we're working on it."
"Really?" Mitch said.
"Is that really the best use of our time? I mean, we have a near-Earth resupply to plan, not to mention figuring out how to get Watney to Schiaparelli. We've got a lot on our plates."
"You're damn right we have a lot on our plates," Teddy fumed. "After your little stunt, we're committed to this thing."
"Alleged stunt," Mitch said. "I suppose Annie will tell the media we decided to try the risky maneuver, and she'll leave out the mutiny part."
"Of course," Teddy said. "Otherwise, we'd look like idiots."
"Guess that's me off the hook, then," Mitch smiled. "Can't fire me for enacting NASA policy. Allegedly enacting it, that is. I guess Lewis is off the hook, too. And maybe Watney gets to live. Happy endings all around."
"You may have killed the whole crew," Teddy countered. "Ever think of that?"
"Whomever gave them the maneuver," Mitch said, "only passed along information. Lewis made the decision to act on it. If she let emotion cloud her judgment, she'd be a shitty commander. And she's not a shitty commander."
If I can ever prove it was you, I'll find a way to fire you for it, Teddy warned.
Sure, Mitch shrugged. But if I wasn't willing to take risks to save lives, I'd...
He thought for a moment.
Well, I guess I'd be you.
Chapter 17 Log Entry Sol 192
Holy shit, they're coming back for me. I don't even know how to react. I'm choked up. And I've got a shitload of work to do before I catch that bus home. They can't orbit. If I'm not in space when they pass by, all they can do is wave. I have to get to Ares IV's MAV. Even NASA accepts that. And when the mannies at NASA recommend a 3,200-kilometer overland drive, you know you're in trouble. Schiaparelli Crater, here I come. Well, not right away. I still have to do the aforementioned shitload of work. My trip to Pathfinder was a quick jaunt compared to the epic journey that's coming up. I got away with a lot of shortcuts because I only had to survive 18 sols. This time, things are different. I averaged 80 kilometers per sol on my way to Pathfinder. If I do that well towards Schiaparelli, it'll take 40 sols. Call it 50 to be safe. But there's more to it than just travel. Once I get there, I'll need to set up camp and do a bunch of MAV modifications. NASA estimates they'll take 30 sols, 45 to be safe. Between the trip and the MAV mods, that's 95 sols. Call it 100, because 95 cries out to be approximated. So I'll need to survive away from the hab for 100 sols. What about the MAV? I hear you ask in my fevered imagination. Won't it have some supplies, air and water at the very least? Nope, it's got dick all. It does have air tanks, but they're empty. An Ares mission needs lots of O2, N2, and water anyway. Why send more with the MAV? Easier to have the crew top off the MAV from the hab. Fortunately for my crewmates, the mission plan had Martinez fill the MAV tanks on Sol 1. The flyby is on Sol 549, so I'll need to leave by 449. That gives me 257 sols to get my shit in gear. Seems like a long time, doesn't it? In that time, I need to modify the rover to carry the atmospheric regulator, oxygenator, and water reclaimer. I call them the big three. All three need to be in the pressurized area, but the rover isn't big enough. All three need to be running at all times, but the rover's batteries can't handle that load for long. The rover will also need to carry all my food, water, solar cells, extra battery, my tools, some spare parts, and Pathfinder. As my sole means of communication with NASA, Pathfinder gets to ride on the roof, Granny Clampett style. I have a lot of problems to solve, but I have a lot of smart people to solve them. Pretty much the whole planet Earth. NASA is still working on the details, but the idea is to use both rovers, one to drive around, the other to act as a trailer for all the shit I have to bring. I'll have to make structural changes to that trailer, and by structural changes I mean cut a big hole in the hull. Then I can move the big three in and use hab canvas to loosely cover the hole. It'll balloon out when I pressurize the rover, but it'll hold. How will I cut a big chunk out of a rover's hull? I'll let my lovely assistant Venkat Kapoor explain further. 1400 hours, 38 minutes. JPL. I'm sure you're wondering how to cut a hole in the rover. Our experiments show a rock sample drill can get through the hull. Wear and tear on the bit is minimal. Rocks are harder than carbon composite. You can cut holes in a line, then chisel out the remaining chunks between them. I hope you like drilling. The drill bit is 1 centimeter wide. The holes will be 0.5 centimeters apart, and the length of the total cut is 11.4 meters. That's 760 holes, and each one takes 160 seconds to drill. Problem. The drills weren't designed for construction projects. They were intended for quick rock samples. The batteries only last 240 seconds. You do have two drills, but you'd still only get three holes done before needing to recharge. And recharging takes 41 minutes. That's 173 hours of work, limited to 8 EVA hours per day. That's 21 days of drilling, and that's just too long. All our other ideas hinge on this cut working. If it doesn't, we need time to come up with new ones. So we want you to wire a drill directly to hab power. The drill expects 28.8 volts and pulls 9 amps.
The only lines that can handle that are the rover recharge lines. They're 36 volts, 10 amps max. Since you have two, we're comfortable with you modifying one. We'll send you instructions on how to step down the voltage and put a new breaker in the line, but I'm sure you already know how. I'll be playing with high voltage power tomorrow. Can't imagine anything going wrong with that. Log entry, Sol 193. I managed to not kill myself today, even though I was working with high voltage. Well, it's not as exciting as all that. I disconnected the line before I fucked with it. As instructed, I turned a rover charging cable into a drill power source. Getting the voltage was a simple matter of adding resistors, which my electronics kit has in abundance. I had to make my own 9-amp breaker. I strung three 3-amp breakers in parallel. There's no way for 9 amps to get through that without tripping all three in rapid succession. Then I had to rewire a drill, pretty much the same thing I did with Pathfinder. Take out the battery and replace it with a power line from the hab, but this time it was a lot easier. Pathfinder was too big to fit through any of my airlocks, so I had to do all the rewiring outside. Ever done electronics while wearing a spacesuit? Pain in the ass. I even had to make a workbench out of MAV landing struts, remember? Anyway, the drill fit in the airlock easily. It's only a meter tall and shaped like a jackhammer. We did our rock sampling standing up, like Apollo astronauts. Also, unlike my Pathfinder hatchet job, I had the full schematics of the drill. I removed the battery and attached a power line where it used to be. Then, taking the drill and its new cord outside, I connected it to the modified rover charger and fired it up. Worked like a charm. The drill whirled away with happy abandon. Somehow I had managed to do everything right the first try. Deep down, I thought I'd fry the drill for sure. It wasn't even midday yet. I figured why not get a jump on drilling. 10:07. Watney. Power line modifications complete. Hooked it up to a drill, and it works great. Plenty of daylight left. Send me a description of that hole you want me to cut. 10:25. JPL. Glad to hear it. Starting on the cut sounds great. Just to be clear, these are modifications to Rover 1, which we have been calling the trailer. Rover 2, the one with your modifications for the trip to Pathfinder, should remain as is for now. You'll be taking a chunk out of the roof, just in front of the airlock in the rear of the vehicle. The hole needs to be at least 2.5 meters long and the full 2 meters width of the pressure vessel. Before any cuts, draw the shape on the trailer and position the trailer where Pathfinder's camera can see it. We'll let you know if you got it right. 10:43. Watney. Roger. Take a pic at 11:30 if you haven't heard from me by then. The rovers are made to interlock so one can tow the other. That way you can rescue your crewmates if the shit hits the fan. For that same reason, rovers can share air via hoses you connect between them. That little feature will let me share atmosphere with the trailer on my long drive. I'd stolen the trailer's battery long ago. It had no ability to move under its own power, so I hitched it up to my awesomely modified rover and towed it into place near Pathfinder. Venkat told me to draw the shape I planned to cut, but he neglected to mention how. It's not like I have a Sharpie that can work out on the surface. So, I vandalized Martinez's bed. The cots are basically hammocks, lightweight string woven loosely into something that's comfortable to sleep on. Every gram counts when making stuff to send to Mars. I unraveled Martinez's bed and took the string outside. I taped it to the trailer hull along the path I planned to cut. Yes, of course, duct tape works in a near vacuum. Duct tape works anywhere. Duct tape is magic and should be worshipped. I can see what NASA has in mind. The rear of the trailer has an airlock that we're not going to mess with. The cut is just ahead of it and will leave plenty of space for the Big Three to stand. I have no idea how NASA plans to power the Big Three for 24.5 hours a day and still have energy left to drive. I bet they don't know either. But they're smart. They'll work something out. 11:49. JPL. What we can see of your planned cut looks good. We're assuming the other side is identical. You're cleared to start drilling. 12:07.
Watney.
That's what she said.
1200 hours, 25 minutes.
JPL.
Seriously, Mark? Seriously?
First, I depressurized the trailer. Call me crazy, but I didn't want the drill explosively launched at my face. Then I had to pick somewhere to start. I thought it'd be easiest to start on the side. I was wrong. The roof would have been better. The side was a hassle because I had to hold the drill parallel to the ground. This isn't your dad's Black & Decker we're talking about. It's a meter long and only safe to hold by the handles. Getting it to bite was nasty. I pressed it against the hull and turned it on, but it wandered all over the place, so I got my trusty hammer and screwdriver. With a few taps, I made a small chip in the carbon composite. That gave the bit a place to seat, so I could keep drilling in one place. As NASA predicted, it took about 2 minutes to get all the way through. I followed the same procedure for the second hole, and it went much smoother. After the third hole, the drill's overheat light came on. It wasn't designed to operate constantly for so long. Fortunately, it sensed the overheat and warned me. So I leaned it against the workbench for a few minutes, and it cooled down. One thing you can say about Mars, it's really cold. The thin atmosphere doesn't conduct heat very well, but it cools everything eventually. I had already removed the drill's cowling. The power cord needed a way in. A pleasant side effect is the drill cools even faster, though I'll have to clean it thoroughly every few hours as dust accumulates. By 1700 hours, when the sun began to set, I had drilled 75 holes. A good start, but there's still tons to do. Eventually, probably tomorrow, I'll have to start drilling holes that I can't reach from the ground. For that, I'll need something to stand on. I can't use my workbench. It's got Pathfinder on it, and the last thing I'm going to do is mess with that. But I've got 3 more MAV landing struts. I'm sure I can make a ramp or something. Anyway, that's all stuff for tomorrow. Tonight is about eating a full ration for dinner. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm either getting rescued on Sol 549 or I'm dying. That means I have 35 days of extra food. I can indulge once in a while. Log entry, Sol 194. I average a hole every 3.5 minutes. That includes the occasional breather to let the drill cool off. I learned this by spending all damn day drilling. After 8 hours of dull, physically intense work, I had 137 holes to show for it. It turned out to be easy to deal with places I couldn't reach. I didn't need to modify a landing strut after all. I just had to get something to stand on. I used a geological sample container, also known as a box. Before I was in contact with NASA, I would have worked more than 8 hours. I can stay out for 10 before even dipping into emergency air. But NASA's got a lot of nervous Nellies who don't want me out longer than spec. With today's work, I'm about quarter of the way through the hole cut, at least quarter of the way through the drilling. Then I'll have 759 little chunks to chisel out, and I'm not sure how well carbon composite is going to take to that. But NASA'll do it 1,000 times back on Earth and tell me the best way to get it done. Anyway, at this rate, it'll take 4 more days of boring-ass work to finish the drilling. I've actually exhausted Lewis's supply of shitty 70s TV, and I've read all of Johansson's mystery books. I rifled through other crewmate stuff to find entertainment, but all of Vogel's stuff is in German. Beck brought nothing but medical journals, and Martinez didn't bring anything. I got really bored, so I decided to pick a theme song. Something appropriate, and naturally, it should be something from Lewis's god-awful 70s collection. It wouldn't be right any other way. There are plenty of great candidates. Life on Mars by David Bowie, Rocket Man by Elton John, Alone Again Naturally by Gilbert O'Sullivan. But I settled on Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees. Log entry, Sol 195. Another day, another bunch of holes. 145 this time. I'm getting better. I'm halfway done. This is getting really old. But at least I have encouraging messages from Venkat to cheer me on. 1700 hours, 12 minutes. Watney. 145 holes today. 357 total. 1700 hours, 31 minutes. JPL. We thought you'd have more done by now. Dick. Anyway, I'm still bored at night. I guess that's a good thing. Nothing's wrong with the hab. There's a plan to save me, and the physical labor is making me sleep wonderfully.
I miss tending the potatoes. The hab isn't the same without them. There's still soil everywhere. No point in lugging it back outside. Lacking anything better to do, I ran some tests on it. Amazingly, some of the bacteria survived. The population is strong and growing. That's pretty impressive when you consider it was exposed to near vacuum and subarctic temperatures for over 24 hours. My guess is pockets of ice formed around some of the bacteria, leaving a bubble of survivable pressure inside, and the cold wasn't quite enough to kill them. With hundreds of millions of bacteria, it only takes one survivor to stave off extinction. Life is amazingly tenacious. They don't want to die any more than I do. Log entry, Sol 196. I fucked up. I fucked up big time. I made a mistake that might kill me. I started my EVA around 0800 hours 45 minutes, same as always. I got my hammer and screwdriver and started chipping the trailer's hull. It's a pain in the ass to make a chip before each drilling, so I make all the day's chips in a single go. After chipping out 150 divots, hey, I'm an optimist, I got to work. It was the same as yesterday and the day before. Drill through, relocate. Drill through, relocate. Drill through a third time, then set the drill aside to cool. Repeat that process over and over till lunchtime. At 1200 hours, I took a break. Back in the hab, I enjoyed a nice lunch and played some chess against the computer. It kicked my ass. Then back out for the day's second EVA. At 1300 hours 30 minutes, my ruination occurred, though I didn't realize it at the time. The worst moments in life are heralded by small observations, the tiny lump on your side that wasn't there before, coming home to your wife and seeing two wine glasses in the sink. Anytime you hear, "We interrupt this program." For me, it was when the drill didn't start. Only 3 minutes earlier, it was working fine. I had finished a hole and set the drill aside to cool, same as always. But when I tried to get back to work, it didn't work. The power light wouldn't even come on. I wasn't worried. If all else failed, I had another drill. It would take a few hours to wire it up, but that's hardly a concern. The power light being off meant there was probably something wrong with the line. A quick glance at the airlock window showed the lights were on in the hab, so there were no systemic power problems. I checked my new breakers, and sure enough, all three had tripped. I guess the drill pulled a little too much amperage. No big deal. I reset the breakers and got back to work. The drill fired right up, and I was back to making holes. Doesn't seem like a big deal, right? I certainly didn't think so at the time. I finished my day at 1700 hours after drilling 131 holes. Not as good as yesterday, but I lost some time to the drill malfunction. I reported my progress. 1700 hours, 8 minutes. Watney. 131 holes today. 488 total. Minor drill issue. It tripped the breakers. There may be an intermittent short in the drill, probably in the same attachment point of the power line. Might need to redo it. Earth and Mars are just over 18 light minutes apart now. Usually NASA responded within 25 minutes, but this time no reply came. Remember, I do all my communication from Rover 2, which relays everything through Pathfinder. I can't just lounge in the hab awaiting a reply. I have to stay in the rover until they acknowledge the message. 1700 hours, 38 minutes. Watney, have received no reply. Last message sent 30 minutes ago. Please acknowledge. I waited another 30 minutes. Still no reply. Fear started to take root. Back when JPL's Nerd Brigade hacked the rover in Pathfinder to be a poor man's IM client, they sent me a cheat sheet for troubleshooting. I executed the first instruction. 1800 hours, 9 minutes. Watney. System_command:status. 1800 hours, 9 minutes. System:. Last message sent 0 hours, 31 minutes ago. Last message received 26 hours, 17 minutes ago. Last ping reply from probe received 4 hours, 24 minutes ago. Warning. 52 unanswered pings. Pathfinder was no longer talking to the rover. It had stopped answering pings 4 hours and 24 minutes ago. Some quick math told me that was around 1300 hours 30 minutes today, the same time the drill died. I tried not to panic. The troubleshooting sheet has a list of things to try if communication is lost. They are, in order: 1.
Confirm power still flowing to Pathfinder. 2. Reboot rover. 3. Reboot Pathfinder by disconnecting, then reconnecting power. 4. Install rover's comm software on the other rover's computer. Try from there. 5. If both rovers fail, problem is likely with Pathfinder. Check connections very closely. Clean Pathfinder of Martian dust. 6. Spell message in Morse code with rocks. Include things attempted. Problem may be recoverable with remote update of Pathfinder. I only got as far as step 1. I checked Pathfinder's connections, and the negative lead was no longer attached. I was elated. What a relief. With a smile on my face, I fetched my electronics kit and prepared to reattach the lead. I pulled it out of the probe to give it a good cleaning, as best I can with the gloves of my spacesuit, and noticed something strange. The insulation had melted. I pondered this development. Melted insulation usually means a short. More current than the wire could handle had passed through, but the bare portion of the wire wasn't black or even singed, and the positive lead's insulation wasn't melted at all. Then, one by one, the horrible realities of Mars came into play. The wire wouldn't be burnt or singed. That's a result of oxidization. And there's no oxygen in the air. There was likely a short after all, but with the positive lead being unaffected, the power must have come from somewhere else. And the drill's breaker tripped around the same time. Oh, shit. The internal electronics for Pathfinder included a ground lead to the hull. This way it could not build up a static charge in Martian weather conditions. No water and frequent sandblasting can make impressive static charge. The hull sat on panel A, one of four sides of the tetrahedron which brought Pathfinder to Mars. The other three sides are still in Ares Vallis, where I left them. Between panel A and the workbench were the Mylar balloons Pathfinder had used to tumble land. I had shredded many of them to transport it. Still, a lot of material remained, enough to reach around panel A and be in contact with the hull. I should mention that Mylar is conductive. At 1300 hours, 30 minutes, I leaned the drill against the workbench. The drill's cowling was off to make room for the power line. The workbench is metal. If the drill leaned against the workbench just right, it could make a metal-to-metal connection. And that's exactly what happened. Power traveled from the drill lines positive, through the workbench, through the Mylar, through Pathfinder's hull, through a bunch of extremely sensitive and irreplaceable electronics, and out the negative lead of Pathfinder's power line. Pathfinder operates on 50 milliamps. It got 9,000 milliamps, which plowed through the delicate electronics, frying everything along the way. The breakers tripped, but it was too late. Pathfinder's dead. I've lost the ability to contact Earth. I'm on my own.